yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber bands straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets of screaming now. They brought death to our hometown. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. And here we are at the end of 2013 and year-end show that will air here on January 1st. Okay, what I'd like to do today is continue in this series of discussions of what's wrong with economists. We've had two previous shows. And if you're interested, go back to the archives and listen to those two previous shows, where I'm pretty much criticizing the views of mainstream economics and their analysis of the U.S. and global economy. And I call the two wings of mainstream economics the hybrid Keynesians and the retroclassicalists. You know, they don't always totally agree with each other. But where they do share in common is their inability to really understand how we got into this crisis and where it's going. Neither of them were able to really predict the crisis, in which erupted in 2007-8-9, and neither of which have been able to explain why the crisis has been the weakest recovery in U.S. economic history in the modern times. And neither of them really understand where things are going. And the reason they don't, as I've been arguing, is that they don't have the proper conceptual apparatus to understand. They don't ask the right questions because their concepts prevent them from asking the right questions. The retroclassicalists reach back to a conceptual apparatus well before the 1930s. And that prevents them from understanding where things are going and have a fetish preoccupation with money supply. And the hybrid Keynesians, who I call hybrid because they aren't really Keynes, they've cherry-picked what is useful to them and ignored some real essential elements in Keynes's original analysis. And they pick up some of the 19th century retroclassicalist views, and they try to smash them together, and they get a weird hybrid conceptual apparatus, which also is unable to predict where things are going. Well, okay, so I have an issue with both of them. And during my previous discussions, I also indicated I have an issue with what I call mechanical Marxists, who think that the falling rate of profit explains everything. Well, profits have been rising through this crisis, so how do you explain that? Oh, they go through contortions to redefine the meaning of profits, which globally is impossible to estimate quantitatively anyway, and don't understand that even Marx did not argue the falling rate of profit caused capitalist crises. In fact, he had no theory of capitalist crises like depressions and recessions. Marx looked at a long-run slowing of economic growth under capitalism that would eventually cause political crises because capitalism couldn't continue growth. Well, we're not at that point yet, but it certainly looks like capitalism in the advanced countries cannot maintain the continued economic growth that it had in previous decades. Real investment is slowing, and that's a big problem for them, and it's turning towards more financial investment and financial speculation and securities and so forth, rather than building real things that hire real people that pay them real money. That means real economic growth. So, you know, even Marx was preoccupied with capital accumulation, not falling rate of profits, and therefore investment. And the whole thesis of falling rate of profit is not really Marx. So that's my issue with them. So the question is, what are my views? It's not enough simply to critique others' views, whether they are mainstream economist views in the two wings, or even mechanical Marxist views. So what are my views on this particular topic of explaining how global economy and the global capitalist systems are not really growing very well? If we look at Europe, well, there's a big attempt to spin the fact that it's no longer declining, even though it's had double-dip recessions, in some cases triple-dip, and even though the periphery in Europe, the southern periphery, Italy, Spain, Greece, etc., are in a depression, not in a recession, a depression, and have been for years, four or five years now, and even though France and other mainstream economies are flat on their back, can't get going, stagnant, zero growth. We got a little bit of recovery in Germany, but its growth has dramatically slowed, and a little bit of a recovery in the UK. But nothing that you could say is a sustained economic recovery. Europe is the sick boy of the global economy and remains so. And then you look at what's happening in Japan. Well, Japan, since 2008, has been in a triple-dip recession. Oh, yes, it's recently sort of recovered from that triple-dip, but not anything that you could call robust economic growth. And it's been bouncing up and down for quite some time in shallow recessions and weak recoveries, which is a hallmark of the current economic condition globally here. Short, shallow recoveries, way below historical par, followed by relapses economically, and that continues off and on, stop-go, bouncing along the bottom. That's what I have been calling an epic recession, which is different from a great recession, a term that mainstream economists have used and never really defined, and it's different than a normal recession, where you have a quick V-shaped kind of recovery after a shallow decline, and it's different than a bona fide depression, where you have a decline that goes on for 4 or 5 years, continuing lower and lower. So, epic recession is the core concept, in my view, which I define quantitatively and qualitatively and differentiate it from normal recessions and depressions in my book, published in 2010, called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. Now, you can find that online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and even on my website, Kikros Productions, or my blog, jackrasmus.com. And that book is divided into three parts. The first part is a theoretical analysis of epic recession, and why, in other words, the crisis, the crash in 2007-09 was so deep, why, as I predicted then, there would be no robust recovery but a bouncing along the bottom for quite some time that could go on for years, and why eventually it will slip again into another financial crisis and contraction of the real economy that would be worse than 2007-2009. That was the theme of my 2010 book, Epic Recession. And the first part of that book was to describe the theoretical basis for this by going back and revisiting themes that were originated in the 1930s by Keynes, by another economist, Irving Fisher, who wrote about the debt deflation theory of depressions, and Keynes, who wrote about why normal fiscal monetary policies do not work when you have a financial crash. Yes, Keynes talked about money and interest and theory before he wrote the general theory in 1936. These are works that mainstream economists never even look at, let alone read the general theory. So I went back to those two sources and looked at how they explained the Great Depression of the 30s and developed my views from theirs. Not a simple reproduction of what they had to say, because they didn't say everything that needed to be said, but there were some interesting antecedents to my views that Fisher and Keynes had talked about. And then in this theoretical part of Epic Recession book, I also picked up themes from a 1960s, 70s, 80s economist called Hyman Minsky. Very interesting fellow, Hyman Minsky, who also had gone back to Keynes' original thoughts and Fisher's original thoughts and developed them further. Hyman Minsky, read the fellow, interesting fellow, died unfortunately in the early 1990s, but provided an analysis of what was happening to finance capital in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. He was around and writing when we had this late 1980s real estate crash, the housing crash, and the junk bond crash, and the stock market crash in the late 1980s, which were kind of a dress rehearsal for what was going to happen here in the 2000s. And his analysis looked at the idea of fragility. How can the financial system become fragile? And why does it become fragile? And when it does, and it implodes, brings down the rest of the economy. This was something he foresaw occurring as finance capital became more and more important, beginning back in the 1960s. 1966 was sort of the date Minsky picked up on to show that the financial system was outrunning the rest of the economy and the ability to regulate it, and it caused a mini financial crash in 1966. And the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, responded by pumping up the money supply, in other words, providing even more liquidity, to offset that imminent crisis. It was over new financial instruments that the banks were creating at the time. And then in 1970, there was another financial crash that was imminent, and the banks, Federal Reserve, jumped in and bailed out the banks again. And then in 1974-75, another financial problem. So in other words, the financial problems were beginning to appear again, as they had in before 1930. And the response of the Federal Reserve was to bail out the banks, which is its number one responsibility, lender of last resort. Goes all the way back to the creation of the Federal Reserve. More on that in just a minute. So Minsky sees these financial instability events growing more frequently, more often, and broader, bigger, more serious. And then he sees 1980s, and it becomes even more serious in the United States. And then we have financial crashes in Northern Europe, in the banking system, and in Scandinavia. And then a big financial crash in 91, 92 in Japan. And, of course, in 1987, we have our stock market retreat. We have the junk bond problems and speculation going on with junk bonds at that time. And, of course, the housing crisis, the dress rehearsal to the subprime mortgage crisis of just a few years ago, occurs in the late 1980s as well. And we see growing problems thereafter in the 1990s. The problem of financial instability and financial fragility is exported. And we see it occurring globally now, not only in Northern Europe and Mexico and so forth, but we see it in Japan. We see it growing in Asia. And that leads to the Asian meltdown in 1997-98. And then that is followed by the dot-com boom and bust in 2000 and 2001 in the United States. And then that eventually was followed by the subprime mortgage crisis and the crash of the credit markets, of which the subprime mortgage was just one of many financial instability sectors. People think that the whole crisis was caused by subprimes, but that was just a symptom of a broader problem. And by 2007-08, the financial fragility and instability is global in nature. So we see it growing from certain markets and certain institutions in the 60s and 70s and becoming international by the 1980s and becoming more virulent, more frequent, and deeper and more serious. Well, Minsky wasn't around for the 2000 events, but the conceptual apparatus he developed kind of pointed to these things that would eventually happen. So Minsky, Fisher, Keynes were the start points for my own analysis, which is set forth in detail in the first three chapters of my 2010 book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. If you're interested in the theoretical views, that first three chapters will provide the theoretical basis for my views. The next several chapters of that book were all about historical examples in the U.S. of financial fragility, how it develops, how it occurs, why financial asset prices collapse and drag the rest of the economy down. You see, you got to distinguish between different causes of recessions and depressions. They're not all caused by the same elements. And that's where mainstream economists goes wrong. They all believe that recessions and so forth are the result of external forces, external factors that shock, external shocks that shock an otherwise balanced system, a system that's in equilibrium and growing and will keep growing. You see, the whole concept of equilibrium is such nonsense, but it's the foundation concept of mainstream economics. So they think the system is balanced and the system will continue to grow nicely unless there are these external shocks. It could be supply shocks, it could be demand shocks. But it knocks the shocks, knock the system off its stability pedestal. Oh, but if you leave it alone, the right-wingers think, the market system will correct these external shocks and bring it back onto a path of recovery. See, that's why right-wingers believe that there should be no government intervention when you have these crises. They believe, the retroclassicalists, they believe that it will return to stability on its own. And if the government intervenes with fiscal monetary policy, what that means is that it's going to prevent the rapid return to stability based on the market system. Okay, that's what the right-wingers believe. So this idea, this conceptual idea of equilibrium leads them to argue that no government intervention is the best policy. We still see that today. Now, the hybrid Keynesians are a little different. They, too, believe in external shocks, but they believe that the system needs a little bit of help and a nudging with government spending and lower interest rates and so forth to help it get back to equilibrium. And once it gets back, then the government can sort of back off. They claim this is the Keynesian view. This is not Keynes. This is their hybrid view, taking the idea of equilibrium and the idea of minimal, nominal government intervention, tweak the system, and help it get back to equilibrium. But they both believe in equilibrium. Well, Minsky did not believe in this. Minsky believed that there was something fundamental endogenous within the capitalist market system that led it towards instability. It wasn't naturally in equilibrium and gets knocked off its pedestal by external shocks within it, and particularly within the financial system. There was this stability that was endemic, that was natural to a capitalist market economy that tended to grow over time, creating more and more instability in the financial sector until you had a financial crash, and then that was followed, dragged down the rest of the economy, and then you had a serious situation. Well, I believe that these kind of financial-induced sharp contractions are what I call epic recessions, you see. That doesn't mean all recessions are epic recessions, or that all recessions will lead, even epic recessions, lead naturally, inevitably towards a depression, but it can. under certain conditions, was my argument. So epic recessions were not normal recessions. Normal recessions caused by external shocks. In other words, mainstream was not totally wrong. You can look at external shock-induced recessions. For example, 1981, Ronald Reagan, what did he do? He caused, Paul Volcker, Federal Reserve Chair, caused a recession. Make everyone else pay, consumers and workers pay, for the runaway inflation of the late 1970s was the idea. Cause a recession. And that's exactly what he did. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates to 18%. Yes, the lowest best rate you could get if you were a bank was 18%. In other words, shut down the economy, which had tremendous negative impact on the housing market, of course, precipitated the housing problems of the 80s. Ronald Reagan did that, one of his many terrible legacies. Caused the economy to enter into a deep recession as a way of shaking out inflation. Okay, that was an external shock, a demand-induced recession. And the recovery was fairly quick once the policymakers decided to do it from that recession. And we've had a number of normal recessions, as I call them, caused by these external shocks. But that's not the explanation of all recessions, and certainly not the explanation of a depression, right? Epic recessions are different because they are caused by financial shocks and the financial instability that develops over years that Minsky was talking about, and that Keynes and Fisher saw elements of way back in the 1930s. So epic recessions are a different animal, quantitatively and qualitatively. Quantitatively, they are much worse. Epic recessions are much worse. And qualitatively, they are caused by different elements. They are not caused by external shocks, policy or supply shocks. Okay, but mainstream economics doesn't make this distinction. They think they can explain all three types of events, normal recessions, epic recessions, and depressions with the same deficient conceptual apparatus, and they can't. And that's why they can't predict these things when they occur or understand that epic recessions drag out a long time. You can't get a full, robust, normal recovery when you have an epic recession, particularly if you engage in the type of fiscal monetary traditional policies which we've seen. What happens is you have a bumping along the bottom for an extended period of time. And it takes a different set of policies to end an epic recession, a different set. Okay, and going back to my book, Epic Recession, the next three chapters, 4, 5, 6, were based on analysis of historical examples of epic recessions and or depressions in the U.S., and there was not normal recessions. I looked at the Great Depression of the 1830s, 1837 to 44, and what caused that? Well, that was a financial-induced depression. Speculation in canal bonds, state bonds and canal bonds, when the canals went bust, the canal spending went bust, and the government reacted by pulling money out of the system instead of putting it in, explains much of that. And then we have the late 1850s, and we had the almost another epic recession and depression, but that was cut short by spending during the Civil War. But we had a bona fide depression once again in the 1870s. This time, speculation in railroads and railroad bonds precipitated that financial crash and that 6-year-long depression. And then we had it again in the 1890s. Another example brought up in my book. Again, a second round of railroad speculation and railroad expansion, and also development of the manufacturing in the United States and the stock speculation and so forth with regard to that. So we had three great depressions, at least in the 1800s. And each of them was also precipitated by financial overinvestment and speculation in financial securities. Now, the question is, what's the difference between the epic recession and a depression? Well, my analysis is that a depression occurs when an epic recession transforms into a depression. In other words, you have a financial crisis that occurs that causes one or more financial markets to collapse, asset prices collapse. That causes a freeze-up of the financial banking system, and loans and money and other credit gets cut off, reduced to the rest of the economy, and brings the rest of the economy down. And then there is a kind of a vicious cycle that occurs between the real side and the financial side of the economy that causes further defaults and further contractions of both the financial and the real side of the economy. And what happens is eventually you have a banking crash, a second banking crash, or you can have subsequent banking crashes as this feedback relationship between the real and the financial economy continues and gets worse and drives it further into contraction on both sides. That further contraction leads to a further financial crisis in the banking system. So epic recessions that are followed by banking crashes produce what is called a bona fide depression. Depressions are just a series of banking crashes that occur in sequence that drives the economy to lower and lower levels. And that's what we see in the 19th century. There is no real central bank in the U.S. to bail out the private banks. It just doesn't exist. There is no such animal. So we have these periodic overinvestment in railroads and canals and so forth that lead to too much speculation, an abnormal rise in financial asset prices based on this expansion, which then collapse, which then bring down the financial system, make the real economy worse, and then that real economy sort of feedbacks on the already weak financial system and causes it to get even worse with further banking and financial crashes, and it spirals down. Okay. That's the 19th century analysis. And then I looked at 1907-8, which was another big financial crash that occurred in the U.S., 1907-8, 100 years prior to the 2007-8 crash. And that's another clear epic recession, but one in which the government bails out the banks. Right? No bailout during the 19th century, and these epic recessions result in bona fide depressions. 1907 comes, and we have another crash looking right towards another depression, but the government comes in and bails out the New York banks. The U.S. Treasury joined forces with J.P. Morgan, the guy, the original guy, and they bail out New York banks. The whole thing was precipitated by speculation in commodities, particularly copper commodities and, of course, the stock market. But it was the U.S. Treasury that bailed out the banks. In other words, took money from citizens and consumers and so forth and used all but $5 million, the U.S. Treasury used all but $5 million of its liquid assets to help bail out the New York banks. That stopped the crash, the banking crash that occurred in 1907-8, but it didn't result in the stimulation of the rest of the real economy. The rest of the real economy, we had a recession, a contraction in 1908-9. We had a short recovery for about 12 months. We had another recession in 1912 and a little bit of recovery and another recession in 1913. So it was stop, go, weak, short, shallow recoveries followed by relapses in the economy. And that went on from 1908 to 1914. Okay, so what happened was the U.S. government and capitalists saw that the economy was not, the modern economy needed a central bank in order to help stimulate recovery and, most importantly, to bail out the banks themselves when they crashed periodically. Having the U.S. Treasury do it was politically difficult because it looked too much like Congress was writing a blank check for the banks. So they created the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, is a product of the 1907-8 crash and a very weak recovery, stop-go recovery, triple-dip recession that followed between 1908 and 1913. And in 1913, they passed the Federal Reserve Act, and we're at the 100th anniversary of that Federal Reserve Act. By the way, I'm writing an article on that and the significance of the 100th anniversary, so next week, take a look on my blog and my website, and you probably will find that analysis there. Okay, so we have the 1907 crash, and in my book, Epic Recession, I provide an entire chapter to analyzing that very important event, because it really was the first epic recession of the 20th century. Now, I said before that epic recessions are the anteroom to depressions, but it doesn't mean that automatically an epic recession will result in a depression. Epic recessions transition to depressions when the government and the Federal Reserve or central bank do not bail out the banks. They let the banks collapse. And that, as I said, results in a further downward spiral. Well, in 1907, they bailed out the banks. The Treasury did it, not the Federal Reserve. Whereas in the 19th century, they didn't bail out the banks, and everything descended into bona fide depressions. Okay. But by bailing out the banks does not mean you get a recovery, you see. What it means is that the government prevents the further collapse of the banks, gives free money to the banks. They take that free money, they stuff it in their black hole of collapsed assets, and then they freeze up, and they don't lend to the rest of the economy, and the rest of the economy continues to suffer. You must combine a bailout of the banks with a massive fiscal program, fiscal stimulus, if you want to generate the recovery of the rest of the non-bank economy. Keep that in mind. Very important concept, and we'll talk about that when we get back up to 2007-8. So, bail out the banks in 1907-8 through the U.S. Treasury, no real stimulus to the rest of the economy in subsequent years after 1908, a stop-go, very weak economic recovery, kind of like what we're having today. All right, and we finally do get a bona fide recovery when World War I occurs and the government engages in massive fiscal stimulus and government investment. Of course, it was investment in war goods, but investment is investment. You can argue about types of investment are more stimulant or not. Yes, that's true. But then, you know, war goods production required a lot of people to be hired, a lot of people. And of course, that's what happened during the First World War. So we get finally, 1914-15, the recovery for the rest of the economy that we couldn't get 1908-13. But the point is, the epic recession in 1907-8, precipitated by that crash, did not result in a depression because the banks were bailed out, but it resulted in this stop-go, long-term, subpar, historical stagnation, because we didn't stimulate the rest of the economy at the same time. All right. So that brings us up to the next chapter in the middle of my book, Epic Recession, which looked at the 1929-31 period and crash. And I argue that 1929-30 was another epic recession, but one that this time transitioned into a global bona fide depression. 1907-8, epic recession did not translate into a bona fide depression because the banks were bailed out. But we had a stop-go because we didn't have corresponding fiscal stimulus. Okay, 1929, another epic recession occurs. Financial crash occurs in 1929. And if you look at the real economy, contracted, but it was not yet a full contraction. It was mostly impacting housing and construction and some manufacturing, but the rest of the economy was not doing all that badly. Well, it wasn't doing good, but it wasn't, you know, you're looking at 10 to 15% unemployment rate and contraction in the economy and deflation, you know, worse than a normal recession, but not yet a true total collapse. But the Federal Reserve did not respond to bail out the banks. Well, there was a stock market crash. They didn't understand that the banks were also very fragile. And what happened in 1930 was a first banking crash, regional, in the Great Lakes area. But again, the Federal Reserve, which existed at that time, did not bail out the banks. And then we had a bigger banking crash, a second one, in 1931. Again, the Federal Reserve did not bail out the banks. We had another even bigger one in 32, and then a fourth one in 33. Well, each time we had one of these banking crashes in sequence, and the Fed did not bail them out, what happened was the economy contracted further and further, deeper and deeper, and you get the picture of a depression as a series of banking crashes that occur in sequence. Exactly what happened from 1929 to 33. When FDR Roosevelt comes into office, first thing he does, the very first thing he does is engineer a bailout of the banks with the Banking Act of 33, another one in 34. And guess what? No more banking crashes. Between 1929 and 33, we had 17,000 banks that went under. 17,000 banks. After the Banking Act of 33 and 34, not one collapsed. Okay, so we had finally a bailing out of the banks. Now, one of the functions of the Federal Reserve is lender of last resort. It's supposed to bail out the banks, but it didn't. Its primary purpose in this creation, in 1913-14, was to do so, but it didn't, and the Treasury had to step in under FDR and bail out the banks. And once it did, the economy sort of flattened out. It stopped contracting. The real economy didn't get much better. Roosevelt passed what he called his National Recovery Act, the NRA, National Industrial Recovery Act, and it stopped the banks from getting worse, and it had a little bit of a stimulus on the economy, but not much. The economy kind of moved sideways, 33 and 34. Didn't get really worse, didn't get much better. But after 33, 34, summer 34, it looked like it was collapsing again, or it may collapse again. That was an important juncture, I argue, in the book, because at that point, Roosevelt could have done what big corporations were telling him to do, give us more subsidies, more tax cuts, and so forth, help us more. Another corporate approach. The NIRA was a corporate approach. The NIRA was about raising business prices as a way of boosting business profits to enable business to recover, to hire more people, et cetera. But it didn't work. The NIRA was a flop. And business was saying, well, you just didn't go far enough in 1934 to FDR, and threatening if he didn't come up with another pro-corporate policy that they would oppose him and abandon him. Well, FDR had the courage to say, no more, this isn't working. What we're going to do is stimulate the real economy. We're going to go and stimulate jobs, and we're going to stimulate income for consumers and households in general. And that was the beginning of the birth of the New Deal in 1934. In other words, FDR did not create a New Deal when he first came into office. He created a corporate deal and a bank bailout deal. But when that began to dissipate, he then turned to creating a New Deal. And guess what? In the midterm congressional elections in 1934, people knew the New Deal was coming, Social Security and so forth. And you know what? they voted for even more Democrats in office and gave him the opportunity to begin to really recover the economy by 1935-36. All right, the stimulus, the fiscal stimulus occurred in conjunction with the bailout of the banks. Well, not exactly in the exact time frame, a year or two delay, but they were close enough so we could start to get a recovery in 35 and 36. Okay, so that's a picture of how we actually began to recover from the Great Depression of the 1930s. Now, a little bit more history about that. The recovery, the New Deal, was started to be repealed in 37, 38, and what happened was the economy went back down quickly into depression, and we had a response to that and restoration to some of the New Deal spending in 38, 39, 40, and by then we were preparing for entry into World War II, and massive fiscal spending, as in World War I, was what really drove us out of the Depression fully of the 1930s. Well, that's a chapter in my book. The 1929-31 is an epic recession that results in a bona fide depression because there is no bank bailout and no stimulus of the economy, and not until 33-34 do we get both of those once again. And then the last chapter, 7, of the second part of my book, Epic Recession, is the similarities between 1907-08 and 1929-31 with the 2007-08-09 crash, financial crash and contraction. Another epic recession, no doubt, an epic recession, which we are still in. You see, there's a problem in defining these terms. The government and the NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research, economists say a recession ends when it stops declining further. Well, to me, a recession should end when you get back to where you were when it began, right? No, it's sort of like a half cycle definition of recession. Well, epic recession is about a full cycle definition, not a half cycle, and it's not measured simply by looking at GDP. It's looking at a number of economic indicators. Okay, so we have this epic recession that begins in 2007 and 8, and the whole story is about how you bail out the economy, how you bail out the banks. Well, Obama comes into office, and what does he do? Well, first thing he does, like FDR, is to bail out the banks. Now, who bails out the banks? Well, they start with the TARP program, Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. In the last year of Bush, they passed the $700 billion, Congress does, to bail out the banks. Well, the bank crash was trillions of dollars of lost assets. $700 billion wouldn't even touch a bailout. And, of course, coming from Congress, it was the total wrong approach because it politicized the whole bailout thing, and it looked like the taxpayer was paying for the banks, and that was true. That was the problem with TARP, one of the problems. So the TARP thing blew up in their face in October 2008. And when Obama comes into office, the Federal Reserve and Obama understand that the way to bail out the banks is for the Fed to print money and for the Fed to provide zero interest loans, subsidized loans to the banks. So the banks could come and take free money from the Fed and stuff it in their black hole of collapsed balance sheets and recover that way. Well, that's also in my book in one of the at the end of Chapter 7 of how this bank bailout via the Federal Reserve, which was the original intent of the Federal Reserve. You see, that's the lender of last resort function of the Fed. That's why it was created in 1913. Because the 1907-08 bailout was too political, Treasury, and bailouts, the banks could not bail themselves out. J.P. Morgan tried in 1907-08 to get all the banks to pool their resources to bail themselves out. The banking system and crash was too big. Government, the state, had to bail out the banks. But a Treasury was too politicized a way of doing it, so they created a Federal Reserve that would print money to do it. off balance sheet, as they say, off the federal deficit, because the bailout of the banks has nothing to do with the U.S. government deficit. It has to do with the Federal Reserve Bank's deficit, its own second set of books to bail them out. And that's exactly what didn't happen in 1907-8, because we didn't have a Fed. And in 1929-31, the Fed abrogated its own function of bailing out the banks under Hoover, and we got the Depression. But okay, we get to 2007 and 8, and we get the Fed now finally bailing out the banks quickly. Bernanke knew. That's why he talked about, even before it happened, if necessary, if we have a crash like 1929-30 again, we're going to get up in a helicopter and drop money from a helicopter. In other words, just print and do whatever you needed to fill up the losses of the banks and their balance sheet. Now, not only banks as we know them, J.P. Morgan and Bank of America and so forth, but now this huge shadow banking system. What are the shadow banks? Oh, well, these are all other financial institutions, you know, pension funds, insurance companies, finance companies, private equity firms, money market funds, hedge funds, et cetera, et cetera. This is the shadow banking system. And that had to be bailed out, too, because the investment banks, also part of the shadow banking system, were, and the hedge funds kind of precipitated the crash in 2007. I mean, they were the guys who were overexpended with regard to subprime mortgages, which brought them down. And so bailing out them was a problem as well in 2007 and 9. And certain policies were undertaken to do that. Now, I just started talking about that in Chapter 7 of Epic Recession, my book. But the book was written at the end of 2009, appeared in April 2010. So only the outlines of this bailout were discussed in that book. But I did predict that there would be a very low-level stop-go recovery, that the policies of bailing out the banks, if they weren't accompanied by massive fiscal stimulus, would result in the stabilizing of the bank, but something of a recovery for the rest of the economy after 2008 that looked very much like 1908-1913, stop-go, relapses, short shadow recoveries followed by declines. And that's exactly what happened. My prediction was exactly true, because I saw in even as early as 1909, while there was a bank bailout going on, there was not a real stimulus to the economy. You know, Obama's first recovery bill program in 2009 provided only about $800 billion in stimulus. Most of that was tax cuts for corporations and the rich, and they sat on that money, by the way. They did not spend it, or they created huge cash reserves, or they sent it overseas to emerging markets, or they stuffed it into financial investments once again. But it didn't get into the rest of the economy. Only $800 billion. At the time, I said we needed $2.5 trillion, a 15% of GDP stimulus, most of which had to be job-creating focused. That's another problem with Obama's recovery. Never was a jobs program anywhere in the last 6 years under Obama. The whole idea was to give money to corporations, tax cuts, so that they would then spend it on creating jobs. Well, they didn't spend it on creating jobs. They hoarded it or sent it offshore or invested in financial securities. And that's why we get this stop-go recovery that we've seen for quite some time here going on, and it's still going on. Okay, subpar growth of 1.7% when we should be growing 4% in the last 5 years. Yeah, even normal recessions, 3.5-4% recovery, sustained year to year. But, we've been growing 1%, 1.5%, so forth. Subpar, stop go. And we can even make an argument that we had a double dip back in early 2011 if we calculated the inflation adjustment properly, which we don't. And even at the end of 2012, the economy came to a halt virtually. So very much a stop-go kind of a recovery here. My subsequent book to Epic Recession, which appeared in April 2010, was Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, which appeared in May 2012, in which I analyzed the failure of Obama economy, Obama policies, fiscal monetary policies to bail out the economy, to bail out the real economy. They bailed out the banks, of course. You know, but he did not really bail out the real economy. He didn't do nothing. There was a little bit of stimulus. That's why the stop-go was not as serious as 1908 to 1913. It wasn't a triple dip, actual triple dip recession, which occurred in 1908 to 13, but we saw what I call relapses, a below par recovery, short stop go, almost stagnant at certain periods, barely growing in other periods over the last 4 years. So that's confirms my epic recession analysis. We were in a financial induced crash here in 2007-8, the result of speculation in financial securities, derivatives and subprimes and mortgages and so forth, a very generalized financial instability event and crash, which dragged down the rest of the economy. You know, the contraction of jobs in the economy in 2008 and 9 up until the summer of 2009 looked almost exactly like the contraction in 1929-30. But whereas in 1929-30, it spilled over into a depression as we had a series of banking crashes. In 2009-10, we actually had a bailout of the banks. So we didn't. Epic recession did not precipitate into a depression as it did in 1931. Bailing out the banks stops a depression, but does not get you a recovery necessarily and results in the stop-go, stop-go. Until you have a real fiscal stimulus, not the kind of Obama stimulus, tax cuts for corporations, you know, half of that $800 billion was tax cuts for corporations, you know, but a real fiscal stimulus that focuses on jobs, on a real recovery of the housing market, bailing out state and local governments, and so forth. But that did not happen under Obama. No real jobs program, no real housing recovery program, a one-year program of helping the states and then no more, and then waiting on the rest of the economy, the private sector, to try to engineer a bailout, which hasn't occurred and still hasn't occurred. Okay, that's an epic recession, and we are still in that epic recession. We've had a recovery of some of the economic indicators in the last 4 or 5 years, but not only a partial recovery. You know, jobs aren't back where they were when the whole thing began. The housing market isn't back where it was when the whole thing began. State and local government finances have not fully recovered. There's a whole bunch of indicators that show while there's been a little bit of recovery, it hasn't been significant, and we're still bouncing along the bottom. You know, right now we're in a period of a little bit of a upswing here from the third quarter of 2013 here, and I'll talk about that in a subsequent show here when we're able to get the full record for the fourth quarter GDP in the U.S. economy. So we'll look at third and fourth quarter, but it's a little bit of an upswing period that won't be sustained because we are bouncing along the bottom. It's not a zero growth, but it's about a 1 to 1.5% growth, which is about half of what's normal under these circumstances. So definitely an epic recession here, 2007-08, but one in which we bail out the banks, don't provide sufficient fiscal stimulus, and we bounce along the bottom, as opposed to 29-31, where we didn't bail out the banks and we didn't provide a stimulus, as compared to 1907, where we bail out the banks but didn't provide a stimulus, you see. And this kind of an analysis differentiates clearly between bona fide depressions and normal recessions, which mainstream economists don't. They think a depression is just a normal recession writ large. No, it's a qualitatively and quantitatively different kind of an animal requiring a different kind of conceptual apparatus and analysis. And the key to understanding the differences is to understand this interim event, this anteroom to depressions called epic recessions, which are not normal recessions. Okay. And that's where we seem to be going, to bring us back up to the present. In my 2010 book, Epic Recession, I attempted to begin an analysis of what it would take for a true, robust recovery. And that was the last chapter of that book. But it was only partial because it was early. In the subsequent book, Obama's Economy, what I've done there is really look at why the Obama fiscal monetary policies did not truly recover their whole economy, bailed out the banks, but we're still bumping along the bottom. So that was a critique of the policy response. Okay, epic recession followed by Obama's economy. Obama's economy is a natural sequence to epic recession. Now, what I'm writing about now in the book forthcoming later this year is something called What's Wrong with Economists? Well, I've been sort of talking about that, haven't I, in previous shows. Well, I'm going to put this in book form, What's Wrong with Economists? A return to a more theoretical analysis. Now, that's different than a whole bunch of books out there that say, what's wrong with economics? I'm not interested so much in the formal theories in their textbooks. I'm interested in what these economists actually recommend as policy responses to the crisis. And we'll be taking on a whole list in this book of retroclassicalist and hybrid Keynesians. You know, we're going to look at Larry Summers, Robert Reich, Paul Krugman, sort of on the left, Joe Stiglitz, and then we're going to look at more conservative economists, Kenneth Rogoff, Alan Blinder, Mishkin, and the retroclassicalist guys like Taylor and Meltzer and Ferguson, and of course Bernanke and other central bankers, European Central Bank Chair Draghi, King and Carney in the Bank of England, and so forth, right? We're going to – and some odds and ends like Stockman, Jeffrey Sachs, the penitents, as I call them, who have gotten religion and realized that the system does not work. And we'll even look at some businessmen with views on policies, people like George Soros, Bill Gross at PIMCO, Zuckerman, and some very corporate apologists like Martin Feldstein, Glenn Hubbard, Edmund Phelps, and others. So we're going to look at the whole panoply here of hybrid Keynesians and retroclassicalists, but look at them in terms of what their policy recommendations have been. Anyway, today was just my attempt to differentiate my views from the retroclassicalists and the hybrids that I've been talking about in previous shows. So What's Wrong with Economists, Part 3 was today's show, and we'll get back to looking at the real economy in the short term here in subsequent shows. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, looking forward to a very interesting 2014.